What if insomnia is not just biological, but also cultural, emotional, and even spiritual? In today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Bruce Forman, a psychologist, behavioral sleep medicine specialist, and ordained rabbi whose work brings together modern sleep science, trauma-informed care, meditation, and Jewish spiritual traditions. Together, we explore why so many people struggle with sleep anxiety, why the mind becomes more active the harder we try to sleep, and what it really means to let go of control at night. This conversation is thoughtful, deeply human, and unexpectedly calming. I'm your host, Dr. Yi Shen. Let's dive deep into sleep. Hi, Dr. Forman. Welcome to Deep Into Sleep podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a really great opportunity since nobody's ever asked me to be on a podcast before.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you. I know you have a lot of wisdom. You sure should share that with the world, you know. And let's start from sleep medicine. What makes you interested in entering the field of behavioral sleep medicine?
Okay, well, back when I was a kid, I was clearly ADHD gifted, although they just called me lazy. And so in school, you know, I'd be kind of, you know, out in space because I got turned off when they were teaching the dumb kids. But I liked learning. I hated school, but discovered I liked learning. So I was always doing things to learn. And that continued throughout my life and my career. And to this day, I'm still interested in learning things. Some years ago, I discovered behavioral sleep medicine. I went to a training with Michael Perlis in Philadelphia. And it was like, oh my God, I had no idea how really significant sleep was. Had I known, I would have specialized in sleep for my career instead of what I did, which was marriage and family therapy and hypnotherapy. And of course, when I was younger, I did a research postdoc, but there was no such thing as a behavioral sleep medicine a long time ago. So I decided that because sleep is so important to physical health and emotional well-being, that I would start switching over and specialize in behavioral sleep medicine and just learned as much as I could, continued going to workshops. I listened to webinars from Harvard Medical School's sleep medicine program and Michael Grandner's webinars on sleep from University of Arizona. And I just keep learning. Helping people get better sleep has become my passion.
Yeah, I admire the learning spirit. Totally agree. When I entered the field by accident, also, I thought I knew everything about sleep. There's nothing more to learn about sleep. And then I was totally shocked. So I was curious, after you start learning sleep, is there anything you did not know before or anything you thought you knew, but then it shocked you after you enter this field?
Just how much is there and how much sleep is impacted by things in life. So for example, I was looking at ACEs, the adverse childhood events, and looked up some research. And sure enough, when kids have high ACEs scores, they have poor sleep that continues well into adulthood. I was looking at other traumatic things. I recently had a paper come out in Journal of Contemporary Psychotherapy on assessment of sleep as a threat assessment of sleep as a factor in insomnia. and with implications for CBTI. So I keep finding things that are interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I did, because I didn't have an opportunity to get formal training when I was younger, is I discovered that the World Sleep Academy, which was part of the World Sleep Society, had a program in sleep medicine. So I thought that would help me because they focused on diagnosis and assessment and treatment things. And so I enrolled in this training program in sleep medicine. I was probably one of two psychologists who were in it. There are mostly physicians around the globe. And so I went through that training and learned way more about polysomnography than I ever thought I wanted to know. And I kept thinking I was in over my head. And went through that, and then when I finished up, or was near finishing, the director of the program contacted me and said she wanted to schedule a Zoom meeting with me. And I thought, she's going to throw me out of the program. but instead, she wanted to know if I wanted to be the course director for a new course that they're developing. On insomnia. So I said, yeah, sure. And so I got involved in that. You're going to be one of the instructors in that. And I'm really thankful for that. In my work, in trying to learn about the importance of culture in sleep problems, because, you know, we're dealing with people from all over the globe. Mm-hmm. And so I started researching and looking at that, and I found a lot of incredible things, summed up as sleep is biological, but insomnia is cultural. And that was really an eye opener.
Oh, I really love that. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what makes you, I want to dig into that a little bit more. What makes you think insomnia is cultural?
Because when we look at how sleep is looked at in other cultures, we can look back to how it was looked at in ancient Greece. We can look at how it was looked at in the Hebrew Bible. We can look at what's happening currently and looking at sleep practices in indigenous societies. We can look at some of the work that's been done on the history of sleep in Western culture. It was recognized that there's a first sleep, and then people get up in the middle of the night, and they would pray, they would study. In Native American cultures, they would socialize. In some of these cultures, sleep is a group event. Often we think of sleep as, you know, you go to your room by yourself or with your bed partner, and in other cultures, it's not that way, which is fascinating. And so the way that sleep is interpreted, it has a cultural basis, and the way we treat insomnia. In some cultures, if you're up in the middle of the night, you're doing things that are socially acceptable. Appreciated in one culture, in Africa, somebody is designated as the night guardian. So the night guardian stays awake while everybody else sleeps, and the sleep is a collective kind of sleep to make sure that they're safe. And so if we look at how we insomnia, if we think somebody is up in the middle of the night, there's something wrong. We pathologize that and we treat that as something to be treated. And in some other cultures, it's normal. You know, so I'm mindful of that because, you know, I live in this culture and the people that I work with come from this culture. So insomnia is a diagnosable problem for us to address. So the take home point is, yeah, but that's not true for everybody around the globe.
Right. That's such a good point. We want to respect each culture. For example, in Chinese culture, we have nap during the day. That's very normal and healthy and it's promoted, right? But in some of the Western countries, it may not be incorporated in the work routine during the day, and people have different opinions of that. And how we view dreaming at night is also different from culture to culture. And that also help us decide clinically what is a problem, what needs to be intervened, what does not need to be intervened. And some people, they sleep, like from other point of view, they sleep not that good, but they feel good about it. And they feel content and they can function very well. It does not bother them how they are sleeping. That may not be really an issue, need to be intervened. For others, right, they sleep okay, but then they think they sleep poorly and they suffer.
Right. And the subjective perspective on sleep or insomnia has to be respected. You know, when I work with people, they sometimes want to use their wearables, and I tell them, well, they're really not yet perfected. They're not clinical quality at this point. So we don't really want to pay too much attention to them. And I say, it's kind of like this. We'd rather have your subjective opinion. If you go to a doctor and you say, I don't feel well, and the doctor says, well, let me run some tests, and then comes back and says, oh, I ran the tests, and you're fine. And then you say, yeah, but I don't feel well. Who should we believe? We're going to believe the tests, or we're going to believe you?
Yeah.
We're always going to pay attention to the subjective because, you know, the people we work with need to be respected, and they need to know that their point of view is valid. So we validate them, and, you know, validation of people and empowering people is, you know, what I've done as a therapist for decades.
Yeah, which can make you a really good sleep psychologist as well. I love that. And when you talk about culture, you mentioned a little bit about Judaism. And I know you recently published a book titled For God's Sake, Go to Sleep, which is very interesting because in this book, and thanks for sending me the book, I skimmed through it a little bit. And I know in the book you combined Judaism and modern sleep science. It's a way how to look at sleep from different angle. I find that fascinating because it's so hard for us to think about how religion, spirituality, and science, right? How they can be combined together to help guide us. Aren't they supposed to be on the different side of the spectrum?
So the idea of integrating spirituality, religion, religiosity, learning about these things and related to health. It came from my familiarity with Harold Koenig's work. He's at Duke, and he heads up, he's in the psychiatry department, and he heads up this program on religion, theology, and health, and has written books about the importance of spirituality in promoting health. You know, the you know, we sum it up with people who are more religious tend not to get as sick as people who are not religious, and when they do get sick, they don't get as sick, and they get better faster. It's like there's a huge literature base on this. And so because I was interested in sleep health, You know, it was natural for me to bridge over and start looking at this. And it was clear there are a lot of things that that are in current sleep medicine and neuroscience that essentially validate things from religious and spiritual teachings. Now, you know, my book is looks at spirituality and sleep from a Jewish perspective because I'm Jewish, but it's true for other religions and faith traditions as well, because we share a lot. You know, sometimes this comes up in therapy sessions. Whether I'm working with people with sleep problems or not, but typically it you know it'll come up in when I'm talking about CBT, mm-hmm. And talking about this monkey metaphor that I like to use.
So I use
this monkey metaphor, and uh-huh. I say, you know, it comes from Eastern philosophy, which holds that the mind is like a drunken monkey stung by a scorpion. I said, this is a metaphor for consciousness. And what happens is, you know, the monkey is drunk and he's running off screaming and he will take you out to crazy land. He'll take you to sad land, angry land, scared land, nervous land. When you got that going on, it's probably because of the monkey. And foolishly, because this stuff is in our head, we think it's valid. But you know, you don't have to listen to the monkey. It's just a monkey. And it isn't you. It's just this thing that you learned in your head. So then I go on and say, well, our job is to train the monkey. That's what I do. I'm a monkey trainer. And so you know, I share the stories of elements of why I like the monkey metaphor. First off, you're okay. It's just this thing in your head, but you're fine. It's this thing in your head you learned and you listen to it. You don't have to listen to it. So I encourage people to train, to give their monkey a name. Call your monkey whatever you want, because you naming it gives you dominion over this stuff in your head, like the way your parents named you. Mm-hmm. And I would go on to say that one of my favorite names was from somebody I was worked with a long time ago, and he called his that little bastard. He would say, you know, I'm doing this, and then that little bastard comes in, does that. And then I say, and the other thing about learning to train your monkey comes from a Jewish mystical tradition. And the Jewish mystical tradition holds that the soul has five levels mm-hmm. of soul. So the lowest level of soul is called nefesh, which is associated with body. And then the next level of soul is called ruach, which is a Hebrew word meaning wind. And that seems to be associated with self-justification. Self-justification that the concept that comes from social psychology that's summed up in this social psychology book that's fabulous, and everything you need to know about it it comes from the title, and the title is Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me.
I like that.
That's the title of the book. Yeah, that okay. tells us about self-justification. And then the next level up is neshama, which is associated with the brain. And you know, for people who are Jewish, sometimes they've heard a reference to somebody else as having a good neshama, somebody who's a good human being. Well, the thinking in Jewish mysticism Jewish traditional mystical thought is that in order to become a good person, you have to use your brain because you have to learn it because of the lower levels of soul. You know, the instinctual parts of us are not to do good. So we need to know, we need to learn what God's laws are in order to do good in the world. The next level up is called Chaya, which is a Hebrew term meaning life. So it's, and it's often it's people's names. The male name is Chaim, and the female name is Chaya. And this is often associated with social justice, doing good, focusing on other people, caring for other people, making sure that there's justice in the world. And then the highest level is called Yehud, which is a Hebrew word meaning one or oneness. So it's very much like this Buddhist concept that we are one with everything. We are one with each other. We are one with all objects at an energy level. So the highest levels of soul, the neshama, chaya, and yehud, are sometimes referred to as divine soul, and sometimes also referred to as our good inclination. Hebrew, it's the Yetzer HaTov, our good inclination. The lower levels of soul that are about selfishness, self-justification, they're about me and my gratification at the level of nefesh, me, the hell with everybody else, it's about me. We sometimes refer to that as the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. Mm-hmm. In morning prayers, people who are Jewishly observant, there's one prayer that asks for God's guidance, that we should not be unduly influenced by our evil inclination or by evil companions. Another term that's used for the evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara, is the animal soul. That's the monkey.
Hmm.
And so then it's like if you're working on managing the monkey, you become spiritually elevated. And because when you're spiritually elevated, you'll be doing healthy things. You'll be able to think more clearly. You'll be able to sleep better. So anyway, that's the spin I have on it.
I really like it, because when you talk about that, I can see how empowering that could be to people, not only emotionally, psychologically, but also how that can benefit their sleep. As psychologists, right, we deal with people day to day. And a lot of time, I feel like it's the thought, it's monkey thought, cause a lot of worries, self-doubt, self-criticism, and or think about things in a very negative way. And so all that just make the symptom worse and worse, and make people stay up late and cannot fall asleep because they worry about so much. If they cannot sleep, their monkey mind told them their health's going to be harmed and they will never be able to sleep. This is going to be horrible, and there are going to be severe consequences. And day after day, they just to scare themselves so much to a level of dysfunction in a way.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And, what I try to explain to people is, so as part of what we do with our cognitive behavioral therapy interventions is we have to, number one, give you a relaxation tool that you can use pretty quickly. And I teach people a cue to associate calmness with the cue. Which I call a magic button. I say, I'm going to give you a magic button. And then I tell them, well, it's really not magic. It's just associational learning, but everybody likes magic. So I teach them that, and I say, but what you really need to do, so that's one part of it. And the other part of it is you need to develop a meditation practice, because meditation practice, you'll get a nervous system reset. Oh, well, why do we need to worry about the nervous system? Okay, well, when the monkey starts and you get activated, this is amygdala. Your malignant, your amygdala is firing, and you need to get out of that fairly quickly. What's happening is you're getting into a sympathetic nervous system mode. Sympathetic nervous system is, you know, fight or flight or freeze. You can't get out of it easily. You can't start talking to yourself because rationally and reasonably, because prefrontal cortex goes offline. So you need to have a way to come down a couple of notches. What we really want to do is help your nervous system to reset, so that you get into parasympathetic functioning forward. So the meditation practice is going to help you get there, because all the stuff we teach you about having more reasonable thoughts, checking out how to get out of the negative loop. Once it's activated, you can't get out of it that easily. I think in cognitive psychology, they call that cognitive diffusion, being able to take a step back, and examine our thoughts, which is the key. You know, once somebody starts doing that, everything else falls into place. But if they're aroused too much, can't get there. So I usually try to integrate meditation into my work with people. But the anxiety you talked about, that is the topic of my next book. Which is currently being copy edited by the publisher, who's Hatherly, and that's on sleep anxiety. The title of that book is Can't Sleep, Won't Sleep, Panicking About Sleep, A Slightly Snarky Guide to Breaking the Sleep Anxiety Cycle. So I don't know when it's going to come out, but eventually it will.
Wonderful. Look forward to the book. And you're going to have to come back to talk about that book, and which we touch on already the core issues of how sleep anxiety could be a big blocker for high quality night of sleep, and especially as part of the cause of insomnia. I feel like when you talk about the monkey mind and the meditation, that reminds me of a child book I used to read when I worked in child psychiatry department. It's talk about, I don't know, remember the name, but it's really talk about monkey mind versus panda mind. And the panda mind especially is what you are talking about, the mindful mind who practice meditation, who can pay attention to the present moment, who can connect with their own body, their own inner world, right? And monkey mind is like what you talk about, jumping around, cannot stay at right now, right here. And it's a lot of anxiety provoking.
Yeah. You know, and it speaks to what we need to sleep. Mm-hmm. What we need to sleep is to not be aroused. We need to surrender. We need to just not care. We need to get into, you know, default mode network, kind of duh, whatever. And to not really care if I sleep or if I don't sleep. Eventually I'll sleep. I'll be fine.
Yeah.
So it's one of the things I recommend to people who are meditating is I tell them, don't meditate before an hour. Stop meditating at least an hour before bedtime. If you're doing meditation that focuses on a mantra, because meditation focusing on a mantra is arousing. You have to pay attention. You have to think about it. That's the opposite of what you need to happen to go to sleep. If you're doing mindfulness meditation and just noticing things, that's different. So I think the take-home point for anybody is that if you're doing mindful meditation before sleep, that's a good a bedtime wind down ritual.
Yes, I agree. And I often add one more thing to my patients to help them understand. Mindful meditation, even though it's helpful, it's just help you relax your nerve system, but it's not a magical wand to really can knock you off and to go to sleep immediately after doing it.
Right.
So because I noticed many of my patients try to use mindful meditation as a replacement of sleeping pills and count on it to have similar effects, but hopefully it's healthier, right? It's not some medication into your body system. But if you are very goal-oriented while you are doing this mindful meditation, try to monitor, am I falling asleep? Am I sleepier right now after a round of this kind of meditation? Then it may backfire.
Yeah. I also recommend that people say some prayers. Because the saying the prayers represents that I don't have to be that much in control. I can just let go and recognize there's something bigger than me that's in charge, and I don't need to be in charge because, well, I'm not really in charge of anything. So I don't need to worry. You know, sometimes I would see people who would tell me they're religious, and they'd be like depressed or anxious about things, and it's like, well, if you really believed in God, there's no way that you could be depressed because things are as they should be. We may not be able to understand them because they're beyond our capacity to understand. And that's why the term faith is used. We just have to have faith in the things that we can't understand and can't control. And that's true for whatever religion or faith tradition people come from.
Yeah.
So being in the habit of either a mindfulness meditation or a bedtime prayer. You know, in Judaism we have a prayer that is universal. We have people who are Jewish, totally not practicing, totally unreligious. And they know this prayer. It's called the Shema. Yeah, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Here, all Israel, referring to the Jewish people, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Everybody knows that one. They may not know anything else, but they typically know that one.
Yeah. Wow, and that's, beautiful.
You know, and that's that kind of surrender to the higher power.
Yeah, surrendering to the higher power, that's a very interesting and important point. So far, what I get from what you suggested is mindful meditation before bedtime or a prayer that is meaningful to each person, to you, whoever listening, right? Maybe helpful. And just try to use whatever way to practice how to let go of control.
That's what it is. It's the letting go.
Yeah, surrendering is a one way of thinking about how to let go. If think about higher power and through prayer, it's easier to connect to that and help yourself let go of control. That would be great. And sounds like controlling is not helpful when you try to sleep.
Yeah, typically not. You know, if we get people who say, well, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night and then I try to go back to sleep. It's like, no, trying is activating. It means it's activating and arousing. You're thinking about things. You need to do the opposite. You need to let go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also like what you mentioned, which is very hopeful that we can use all these different methods to train our monkey brain, to train our body and nerve system and our brain to help ourselves learn how to adjust sleep better. That's very hopeful.
Yeah, I'm really passionate about helping people get better sleep.
Yeah. So before the end, yeah, I love your passion, which is also very important. So before we end, another important question, the last wisdom I want to ask you is if there's one thing people should stop doing for better sleep, what that would be?
They should stop worrying about it. Sleep is self-correcting. We come into the world knowing how to sleep. It's built into us. We didn't have to learn it. We know how to do it. Our bodies have this wisdom. I tell people, pay attention to your body. Your body has the wisdom. Stop listening to the monkey. Pay attention to your body. Your body knows how to sleep. Our bodies like regularity. Our bodies like structure and like rules because that translates into safety, and we need to feel safe to sleep. We don't need to help. We don't need to help sleep. If we don't sleep tonight, okay, tomorrow might be a little adversely affected. If we don't sleep well the night after that, we might have an even worse day. But if we have poor sleep for 3 nights, almost absolutely by the fourth night, you're going to fall asleep. So you don't need to worry about it. Sooner or later, you'll fall asleep. And I think about that and I laugh because one of my friends who is a surgeon would say all bleeding eventually stops. All bleeding eventually stops. You might bleed out and be dead, but the bleeding will stop. But at least with sleep, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, sleep is so unique compared to other health conditions, somehow, in my mind. It's totally the opposite in a lot of aspects.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Foreman. This is wonderful. We look forward to your new book, and I know you have written so many books. For whoever watching and listening, if you want to know more about Dr. Foreman's work, feel free to check out his books, his website. I will put all the links down below in the show note. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye. One of the most powerful ideas from today's conversation is this. Sleep may work better when we stop trying so hard to control it. Our bodies already know how to sleep. But anxiety, hypervigilance, and the monkey mind often pull us away from that natural rhythm, whether through mindfulness, prayer, meditation, or simply learning to step back from fearful thoughts. Better sleep may begin with surrender rather than force. Thank you to Dr. Bruce Foreman for sharing his wisdom, warmth, and unique perspective on sleep and healing. And thank you for going deep into sleep with me. I'm Dr. Ishan, wishing you a restful night ahead.
Sleep is an individual thing. We all sleep differently, and there is so much we can do to improve sleep quality. Keep hope and carry on. This podcast is for general informational purpose only and does not include the practice of medicine or other health professional services. Usage of the information we share is at the listener's own risk. And our content does not intend to be a substitute for any medical and professional services, diagnoses, and treatment. Please seek professional health services as needed.